reverse mortgages. I've been asked not to talk financial on the radio. Send me an email and I'll call you up. Or give me your, I'll give you my phone number. The email address is Richie, R-I-C-H-I-E, underscore, N-Q-E-O, at yahoo.com. That's all I want to say, John. If there's time after the space report, I'd like to ask a question on fireplaces, particular electric fireplaces. Roger?
And Westy, quick comment. Go ahead, Westy. I do very much thank you for explaining your electro network analyzer, but if you were to explain difference between vector signal analyzer and vector network analyzer, I would say that we'll be completing the subject at ratio.
I've never used a vector signal analyzer, therefore I can't speak from experience on that one, Wes. We'll have to do a little bit more research to find out. I am guessing that there's some kind of a phase reference represented between the signal being analyzed and what's displayed on the vector on the a vector signal analyzer. A vector network analyzer has a signal generator with a phase-sensitive detecting circuit with fancy computing-operated displays. A vector signal analyzer sounds like it doesn't have a signal generator on board. As such, where does the phase reference come from in order to display the signals in a vector manner? That I don't know.
It is actually the instrument that measures magnitude and phase of an input signal. But what is happening is it does it at the single frequency within the IF bandwidth of that particular instrument. So what they use it for, error vector magnitude, hot domain power, and spectral flatness of very much known signal. And to explain,
if the word phase is a relative word, if I get a phase reading of 10 degrees, it's 10 degrees of difference in phase between signal A and signal B. If I'm using a vector signal analyzer and I'm not supplying the signal that is the phase reference, where is the phase reference coming from? To read 10 degrees doesn't have any meaning unless it is between two separate signals.
Yes.
Where is the second signal coming from?
No, it doesn't have to be. It's a rate of change. You have a rate of change of the same signal, input signal, at the single frequency with the IF bandwidth of an instrument.
Now, I'm going to have to look into that one further. Paul, WS2N, what's NASA doing these days? Let's see, the last time I heard from you where you gave me that information, I wrote it down. Yeah, can't find it. I think it was something in the vicinity of 131 astronomical units out to Voyager 1. WS2N with the space report. And I think it's going to be space report number 176 of the series. K2LIW. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS Blend. Yep, 76. And, yeah, well, Voyager 1, I think it's 133. I'll have to double check. Voyager 2 is behind. But, well,
using Paul, are you hearing me? Okay, I'm hearing you on the input, but you're coming through the machine less than 50% of the time. It's continuously dropping out every second. One of two things got to happen. You've either got to put a stronger signal on 2585 into the western repeater, or you might have to go to the eastern repeater. As I said, we're getting 50% drop out every single second with what's happening right now. It could be a change in propagating conditions. WS2N, K2LAW.
Notice conditions changing before. Well, this should be a lot better, Dick. How copy this time?
Huge improvement. What did you change, Paul? Great improvement.
Yeah, coming through eastern input. Okay, very good. I'll repeat what I said. We have three launches coming up, three from three different countries, one from our country, one from Russia, and one from French Guiana, which is the European Space Agency. What I was mentioning before was the one from our country going up on the third of this, the third of December, a couple of weeks from now. It will be the Cygnus spacecraft that's going to be bringing up supplies to the International Space Station. They're putting it on top of an Atlas V rocket. That's the first time an Atlas V rocket is ever being used to send anything to the International Space Station. And the reason for that is orbital ATK, that's the one that normally has sent the Cygnus cargo vehicle up to the space station. They had their own rocket, the Antares rocket, and that's not ready yet. That will be ready in the spring of next year. So they made a deal with United Launch Alliance to have a couple of flights using the Antares, Atlas V rocket. How copy so far?
100% copy, Paul. You sound good.
Understood. Very good. The other two important launches, you have one going from Kazakhstan, and that's a crewed launch. The Expedition 46 is going up to the International Space Station, and that'll be on the 15th of December. And then they'll have nine people on the International Space Station for a week to 10 days or so, and then they'll drop back, they'll send another crew back. But that spacecraft, the Soyuz spacecraft, will stay with them for another 6 months. That's usually the lifetime of the spacecraft. And then, eventually that will be returned to Earth. So Expedition 46 has been so many crewed flights up to that space station since, 2000, that it's really starting to add up. Hundreds of different people have been up to the space station. The third one I find interesting is, let me drop it, is the mission from French Guiana on the, they usually use the different platform to get into space. They're using the Vega rocket. It's flown five times before. It's one of the newer rockets that the European Space Agency uses. Instead of the Ariane 5, the Ariane 5 is a big heavy lift rocket. This one is more of a medium lift rocket. And it's going to be launching the LISA, L-I-S-A, Pathfinder to the L-1 position. So Discover will have a company out there. The L-1 position is roughly about a million miles, or four times the distance between Earth and the Moon. That will be located between the Sun and the Earth, and will stay there. And the idea of that mission is to detect gravity waves, and there's some very sensitive equipment on there with the help of NASA. Try and do that. And this is a preliminary launch. They call it a Pathfinder for LISA. They have another upcoming launch probably in the 2030s, which is going to be more involved, which will actually try to do the same thing, detect gravity waves. So you got those three launches coming up. I mentioned that, and there's some other things going on in the space world. Stereo has been fixed. Stereo is the
is not that it's fixed, but they've made communications with it. Stereo is in an orbit around the sun, and there's two of them, one going forward, one going backward, in a relationship to the orbit of the Earth, and that keeps track on the sun. And one of them was out of commission, was behind the sun, and for about 4 or 5 months they couldn't contact it because of that reason. So quite a few things going on. Dick, I don't want to continue on. Maybe have some questions. If we have any more spare time, I can always bring up the other topics. K2RIW, WS Twin, SpaceNet Report 176.
That's Cygnus rocket with the Atlas V. Sounds to me like that has the capability of a whole lot of cargo. Any rough guess as to the number of pounds of cargo that is capable of transporting up all that?
Yeah, the cargo going up to the space station is almost 8,000 pounds. But the whole craft itself is not quite 20,000, but I think around 17,000 pounds. But Atlas V is capable. This is the heaviest thing it's actually launched. But the Atlas V, quite a big cargo. They've launched lighter cargos and sent them all the way to Mars, which includes the Curiosity. Curiosity was 2,000 pounds, but, with the cruise rocket that went with it, that was a lot heavier. But this is interesting to see the different companies cooperate. The reason that this whole happened is, the whole reason happened is because Orbital had an explosion two Octobers ago with its Antares rocket. So they needed to fulfill the contract with NASA, a couple of $1 billion, to do 8 cargo missions to the space station. By the way, they signed up 2 more. Now it's going to be 10. But they need to fulfill that contract, so they made a deal with United Launch Alliance, which is really a combination of Boeing and Lockheed, to utilize the Atlas V rocket. It is bigger. They have plenty of fuel. So normal flights to the space station usually are timed to the second. Antares or the H-2 was launched from Japan when they launched their cargo spacecraft to the space station, or any of them have always been down to the second. Even when the Ariane 5 used to launch the ATV, the automatic transit vehicles, up to the space station for cargo, Atlas V has a lot more margin, so they have a half hour window. They can go 15 minutes before or 15 minutes after. So they're not timed to the second. If they miss a launch because of a storm coming through or a boat downrange or some ridiculous thing that stops the launch, they could either launch before or after, and they have that capability now. And once if they have an okay 15 minutes before, they'll go. They don't care. Doesn't matter. They do have more thrust and more fuel, so no problem. Back to you, Dick.
If that Cygnus with that Atlas V can bring up 8,000 pounds of cargo, and if I'm comparing that to a Progress ship, how many pounds of cargo does a Progress bring up to the International Space Station? Back to you, Paul.
Is about 6,000. The biggest one going now is the H-2. That's around 10,000. The H-2 is by Japan. Previously, before that, you used to get almost 30,000 pounds with the ATV, with the heavy lift vehicle from the European Space Agency. They don't do that anymore. They had contracts of 5 flights, and they've completed that, and they were doing roughly once a year. So that was not, they used to love to have the ATV go up there. But Yeah, that's roughly the numbers. And Dragon has, I think, they're in a probably six and a half downtown bracket. Don't forget they can't get as much weight on as Cygnus now because Cygnus burns up in the atmosphere. Dragon has a heat shield and carries a lot more weight. Parachutes and all. Back to you, Dick.
Is the mechanical construction of the space station, International Space Station, essentially completed, Paul? Or are we eventually going to be adding another module or two? Is it going to become any longer and any heavier? Or is 99% of the construction for the time being through? That's question number one. Question number two, I am guessing the lifetime of the International Space Station is continuously being added on. I'm going to guess that right now they anticipate continuously using it until, I'm picking a number out of the year 2025. What's your guesses on my part, Paul? WS2N, Space Report, K2LIW.
Well, I know U.S., NASA's got to back it until right now 2024. Russia's also now signed up for 2024. They don't have a commitment from the European Space Agency, but from what I read, they'll probably be on board as well. And the same with Japan. So we know it's going to 2024, and probably after that, of course. There are extended times. 2024 has been in existence at one time. As far as modules, Russia still has a planned expansion module, that they plan on setting up on a Proton rocket, probably within a couple of years. As far as we're concerned, this coming winter, probably end of January, I'm thinking, maybe beginning of February, sending up the beam, that's the Bigelow expansion module that will be attached to one of the ports coming off of the Harmony node, Tranquility node. So that'll be going up by SpaceX, and that's a good size heavy unit. It's going to, once it's attached, it's going to inflated with nitrogen, and that'll become part of the space station for a couple of years. As far as anything else, the station is really essentially done. So, except for the expansion module that Rush will be setting up. Back to you, Dick.
The module that's going to be inflated with nitrogen. I'm having a little trouble understanding that one. You're not going to be putting human beings in nitrogen. Does that mean there's an inner wall and an outer wall of that module, and you're putting nitrogen between the two walls? Why is that module going to be inflated with nitrogen? Give me a few words on that one, Paul. Go ahead.
It will actually be inflated with air, but I mean, there's nitrogen charges involved to initially get it going. Attached to a docking port, and that whole structure will be inflated. So it's Bigelow's first attempt with NASA to do that. They have two flying independent modules that were inflated the same way, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, still flying around in space. That was put up probably around 2007 or so, 2008. Bigelow had a Russian rocket take it up, and that was successful. And now this one's actually going to be, there were no people in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. This one will be inflated. Astronauts will be able to go in and out of it. There's no air conditioning. There's no systems on board. There'll be fire prevention and things like that, but there's no active systems on board. So they'll be doing tests and making sure there's no leaks over the next couple of years, and every now and then they'll be able to, they'll open up the door and go inside, poke around, and in and leave again. So it's about the size of a small room, I would say. You know, half the size of one of the nodes. You know, probably about 13 feet in diameter, I think. 13 by 13, roughly. Back to you there.
Okay, I'm starting to get a picture here, Paul. This is an inflatable module. As such, of course, they put all kinds of safety factors into it. But if anything should go wrong with an inflatable module, and it decides to burst, the air of the rest of the International Space Station would go roaring through that portal, a great big opening between it and the rest of the space station, and all that air would rush out in a very short period of time. I don't think human beings could possibly recover from that one. He did say that a lot of the time the door is going to be closed, and I presume the door is closed from the inside toward the outside, so the pressure inside the space station is pushing on that door to close it. So in the worst case situation, the inflatable module should burst or develop a leak. The door closed is protecting you. But as you make the space station bigger and bigger, which means it has more and more exposed area where it could be hit with a meteorite or something could go wrong. And if any one of those modules has a major leak, like a bursting, all that air would run out of the space station in seconds. I don't think there's a chance that human beings could protect themselves from that. Very low probability, but a nasty scenario, unless I've got it wrong. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, Space Report, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Well, Bigelow thinks this thing is safer than what we have up there. Safer in radiation protection, safer in meteor protection. They fired, a meteor-like, objects, on Earth to duplicate and see what would happen. And they find it has better structural defense against meteor impacts, micrometeor impacts, than the big tin cans that we've sent up there. So, I mean, to me, the weakest point is around that collar, where it attaches to the space station. But it's still supposed to be like, 8 to 10 inches thick or something. It's a very thick thing. And levels of Kevlar and some other materials that are supposed to be very strong, and very airtight, So, give you an idea, the Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 was launched back in 2007, so you're flying around for, 8 years now, and there's no detectable leaks on that. I think he's got a good sealed system. Let me drop it. Got, 330 model that's going to eventually come out. Plans on sending that up with the SpaceX Falcon Heavy. Falcon Heavy's 3 Falcon 9 rockets bolted together. And plans on sending at least 2 of them up in the beginning. And they'll dock with one another. And that will become the beginning of the Bigelow Space Station. And, his idea is that eventually you're going to have companies like Boeing utilizing Starliner or what they used to call the CST-100 spacecraft with people docking with this thing, or with even SpaceX with their Dragon. Two of these 330 inflatable modules, and that's his plan. He's got them here on Earth, and he's ready to go. Ready for some time. In his opinion, he's got these things built ahead of, he's ahead of the technology of putting these things into space. He doesn't have the rockets, but he's got these inflatable things. By the way, the 330, the reason they have that, 330 stands for 330 square meters. Each one is like 2 or 3 times bigger than, let's say, the Destiny module on the International Space Station. Back to you, Dick.
You made it sound, Paul, like the inflatable module has a wall thickness of 8 to 10 inches. is that 8 or 10 inches of continuous material, or is there an airspace between the inner wall and the outer wall, and there's webbing in between? If the wall thickness is a solid 8 or 10 inches, I can't believe that something that thick can bend very much. And if it can't bend very much, what does the word inflatable mean? So give me a few words on this 8-inch thick wall of an inflatable module. A few people, K2LIW.
You look at this whole thing, it's going to be attached to the cargo area of the, you know, the unpressurized area of the SpaceX spacecraft. So you're going to have the robot arm pull this thing out. It's about, it looks like around 1/3 of the size of what it's really going to be. So it's not like you're pulling out a little big little balloon and it's going to blow up into this big 13-by-13-foot room. It's a good sized thing, and it's quite heavy. But it's the weight is probably around 1/3 of, let's say, a module, you know, one module of the space station, whatever a module might weigh. Say 30,000 pounds, this thing's probably 10,000 pounds. You know, that type of thing. Yeah, rough numbers, ballpark numbers. So it's quite thick. I've seen it, what it looks like before it's going to expand. It's like a big ring with this big heavy thing sitting on top of it. I mean, it's not small. So, and many, many, many layers of thickness. And it's supposed to be as hard as concrete, they say, to try to drill through this thing. Back to you, Jack.
Boy, that sounds sturdy. If the walls are that thick, and it's called inflatable, what's the rough difference between the volume when it's uninflated versus the volume when it's inflated? Does it change by 2 to 1 or 3 to 1? With walls that thick, I can't believe you're going to fold this all up so it's a thin pancake you're pulling. Over to you on that, K2LIW.
Yeah, it looks like it's about, I'm going to say 3 or 4 to 1, something like that. And it's heavy, you know, so that's why when he sends these big things up that he wants to eventually build a space station, he's got the, Falcon 9 Heavy, this probably the equivalent of 5 million pound thrust rocket to get it up into outer space. It's going to be a heavy contraption, but 1/3, it's 1/3 the weight of whatever, the equivalent of what you would need to get the same amount of space. No, I mean, right now you got as much space on the International Space Station as a 747. If you've been in a 747, you know how big that is. That's how much livable space is in the space station. With a couple of these modules, I don't think he'll be up to that, but he'll be getting close. Two of these modules connected together with docking ports and everything. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, now, we're about to put up an inflatable module. What's the gain? Is it more compact when it's shipped because it's uninflated? It sounds to me like it is heavier in pounds than an ordinary module. It sounds like the wall thickness is thicker than a regular module. So, what do you gain by using an inflatable module? Do you save weight on launch? I doubt it. Do you save volume on launch? Maybe. And because of wall thickness, does it give you more cosmic ray protection when a human being is inside? So what is the major advantages of the inflatable module, Paul? K2LIW?
I know of three that he claims. One is weight. The equivalent of volume that you're sending up. So let's say you're sending up one of these 330 square meter volume, one of Bigelow's modules up. You know, to get that same 330 square meters from a bunch of cylinders that we normally attach together, saying the, from what I've read, is the one-third the weight. So it's really weight, you know. You would, if something's going to weigh 30,000 pounds, this thing only weighs 10,000 pounds. Micrometeors, if you hit the space station with a micrometeor, you know, chances it's not going to go through, but you have more of a chance of it going through the space station than you do if you hit one of these modules. It kind of like absorbs the impact, like hitting a rock against a tire on your car. It's kind of like almost going to bounce off. That type of thing. And then radiation-wise, they say it's better for radiation. Back to you, Dick.
I think you said it has a cross-sectional area inside of its volume of 330 square meters. If it was a square cross-sectional area, that would be 18 meters on a side. Is it a cube 18 meters on the side? 18 meters is almost 16 feet. My goodness, that sounds large. So 330, is the 330, you said square meters, I wonder if that means cubic meters of volume, or are we talking about taking a slice through it, and we're talking about the cross-sectional area of that slice, 330 square meters. So run that one by me again, Paul, K2LIW.
I don't think I should have brought the space station up that he wants to build. The space station are different modules. They're basically the same, but bigger. His vision of the space station would be 230, did I say square meters? Cubic meters of space. Where this thing here, I forget what the cubic meters are for the beam, that's the one that they're going to attach to the space station. This is a test module to see if everything works. The test module is way smaller than this 330 cubic meter thing I'm talking about. The test module, I think, is only about 13 by 13, roughly about 13 feet in diameter, probably about 13 feet deep. You know, that kind of a number, Dick. So it's very small. I mean, it's going to be like a very small room, you know, for you know, two astronauts to hang out in for a while. You know what I'm saying? No windows yet. That'll be on a big one.
Yeah, 330 cubic meters. If I raise that to the one-third power, I now found out what is the length of each side if it was a perfect cube. And that number is 6.9 meters. So it's a cube. If it was a cube, not a cylindrical thing, if it was a cube, it would be 6.9 meters on the side. 6.9 meters is 22 feet. So if it's a cube, it's 22 feet on a side. That does strike me as a good size. And at 14.7 pounds per square inch, boy, the air pressure on those walls on something that large, big numbers here. I can see why the walls are 8 inches thick. The total amount of force in kilopounds on those walls are big numbers. And if you miss a decimal place and that bursts, boy, you're going to make a lot of people unhappy. Oh, you both, K2LIW.
Understood. Remember the Mir spacecraft, the Mir space station, when the Spectre module wound up with a hole in it, you know, that air was rushing out of that small hole very quickly. They had to eventually close the door off of that. That was the end of that. They never went in there again. So I wonder if Bigelow's inflatable module would have survived that. I think it would have. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of that mere leak of a module, and you had to close the door on that module, and many of these modules will have power cables, air ducts, tubing, all kinds of things flowing through that door. To, in a panic situation, eliminate all those things flowing through the door, through the portal, so you can close the door. My guess is that was a rather exciting time. And as long as that module that sprung the leak is at one end of the mirror, and you close off that end module, that doesn't sound anywhere near as bad as if one of the center modules suddenly discovers a leak. And now you've got to close off the door on both sides. And now you don't have one space station, you have two independent space stations with a dead module in between. Life can get complicated in these situations, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, and they had crews of three going up there. Could you imagine that your escape spacecraft was at the wrong end? At the wrong end, that wouldn't be good. Well, you don't have that problem with the space station. If we have enough people up there, you're gonna have spacecraft on both ends on the International Space Station. To escape right now, you don't. Now the Mir, they didn't have like a lot of inline modules. You know, that was like I think two inline modules and a bunch of them sticking out. Perpendicular to those pieces. So I think there was five modules that they had on Mir, and one of them ran. They had a problem with the. That's because the Progress spacecraft slammed into it, put a hole into one of the modules. But yeah, you're right. All the cables and all the ductwork. I mean, all the power, data. All that stuff has been changed for the International Space Station. They learned a lot from Mir, and that's why all your, ammonia lines, everything, all your infrastructure for this International Space Station runs on the outside of the spacecraft, not through all those doors. Back to you, Dan.
In order for me to compare Mir to International Space Station, give me a couple of rough numbers. Is the International Space Station something close to 1 million pounds of total mass? And from end to end, it's a football field long. And is that 10 times bigger than the Mir ever was? Give me some rough numbers on that one, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the Mir was like 1/5 of the weight compared to the International Space Station. I'll have to look that up. I'm pretty sure it was 1/5. Of the total weight. Yeah, the space station's roughly 1 million pounds. And you could go back to the Soyuz, the Salyut space stations. They were even smaller. They were like two modules. You can go back to Skylab. Skylab was probably, weight-wise, pretty close to the weight of Mir, a little bit less. They were, that was a big, one big module. Back to you, Dick.
I just went to Wikipedia, and the rough size of the International Space Station, 73 meters long, 108 meters wide. A meter and a yard is close to the same, so we're going to call it 73 yards long, 108 yards wide, and 20 yards high. So 108 yards long, it is a little bit bigger, at least in its width, a little bit bigger than a football field, 100-yard football field. Boy, that's a lot of size. And just a little shy of 1 million pounds of weight. And all of that with individual launches, where rough rule of thumb used to be $10,000 per pound is the required cost of putting something into orbit. $10,000 per pound and 1 million pounds. That sounds like $10 billion of launch costs. Because of the economy of scale here, it wasn't anywhere near that expensive. But the total dollars invested in the International Space Station, if I had to make a guess, I think we're talking about the same number of billions of dollars as the Large Hadron Collider. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, KQIW?
No, not from what I read. And by the way, I like this one picture. I guess I can find it on the internet. The space station superimposed over a football field, and you see the solar panels, on the port side and the left side are over the end zones of both on the field. It's a good picture. So it's over it's like 330 feet or something.
And then?
So that's always a good picture we got. Money-wise, and $10 billion, I think, would have been a bargain. I think the last time I looked at the total cost was $100 billion that it's all set up. We're not the only country involved. There's 16 of us that have paid the bill on this thing. 16 different countries. Back to you, Dick.
Question to Paul.
16 countries, but I still think we paid a big portion of it. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, Paul, Russia being known from faulty rockets, International Space Station definitely is made for the people to be there. So say, Russian were trying to deliver supplies, whatever, but because they needed the money for another spy, a spaceship, they didn't do the right job. Now, is there any backup? Is there any plan? Is there any emergency vehicle that is ready all the time in case? Enter the ship.
On both the International Space Station and on Mir, the flight rules are you need a seat for everybody that's on board. So at times there's 9 people on board. You have 3 spacecraft that are attached, ready to go. If there's a fire, you'd all jump in there and take off. If there's a problem with the ammonia system and you can't breathe and you have to leave, you could leave. If there's like Dick says, if the beam expandable module breaks and there's as NASA would say, rapid disassembly. That's their word for explosion. It might be all over, but you hope you got enough time to get into the Soyuz spacecraft and get away. Back to you, Dick.
When it comes to describing disasters, people pick up some pretty fancy wording at times. When you buy a kit model airplane, you got a box full of parts, and you put it together. And if you have a real bad crash of an airplane, people will say, well, you've just re-kitted that airplane. So if the International Space Station comes apart, what were those words again, Paul, if it comes apart in a hurry? What words do they use that sound good?
It's the number of times I've read this. They call it rapid disassembly. That's their word for explosion.
Got to use the right words. There was a period of time when the atomic bomb, they didn't want to call it a bomb, so they gave it an official for a period of time, military nomenclature. It was called a troop immobilizer. It's not a bomb. It's a troop immobilizer. Whoa.
And the first one was called the Gadget, right, Dick?
That's right. The Gadget. They had another silly name like that. The Gadget, the toy, whatever. Fat Man and Little Boy, I think, were some of the other names. The Gadget, yeah. They didn't want to call it a bomb for a whole bunch of reasons. They knew there's going to be various pieces of literature flowing around. And they didn't want to alert the other side that a huge bomb was being built. So it was called the Gadget. And I wonder, up until what year was that sort of words used, if you happen to know, John, go ahead.
I know the Gadget was only used for the one at Trinity. And then, of course, Little Boy and Fat Man were the ones for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But I don't know if they continued that. I think they just put numbers on them after that day.
Now, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hiroshima was a design of bomb that had been tested at Trinity. Nagasaki was a design, very different design, that to my knowledge had never been tested. There was a huge leap of faith to to launch that particular weapon?
No, you got it backwards.
Okay. So you're saying the first one was an untested design. Even bigger leap of faith. You're dropping a bomb for the first time that has a very different design than the one that you tested, and that design had never been tested. My goodness. Had that turned into a dud, wow. History would have been very different.
Dick, the first one was a simple artillery shell type compression of the nuclear material. The one they tested at Trinity was the plutonium. It wasn't thermonuclear, but that was the one where all the explosives were on the outside and the timing was very critical. That's why they had to test that one. And that's the one that was dropped at Nagasaki, like 5 miles off target or something.
But still, the first one at Hiroshima was a design that had never been tested. If you had missed a couple of decimal places in your calculation as you bring the two subcritical masses together, at the instant you're starting to bring them together, if the reaction progressed fast enough, they could blow themselves apart before it really got together, and you might get a 0.1% yield. Had somebody made a mathematical error, there's a slim possibility that could have happened. Over here, John, K2LAW.
Oh, yes, you're absolutely right. That was critical. And by the way, as you know, the yield from those bombs were only 1%, 1.5%. Look at the inefficiency of that explosion and all the disaster that still took place there and all those lives that were lost. A lot of people don't know that. They think they're very efficient. They're not that efficient, those first ones. I don't know what they're up to now, but those were only 1%.
Guys, I didn't get the answer to my question. I was asking, is there any emergency rocket that is ready to deliver if the first one fail? Instead of just evacuating the crew, just deliver the supplies when they are needed if the first one fails. And to Adrian, Paul.
I think we're running out of time, but no, that. I mean, if one rocket can't separate, there's nothing waiting on the launch. But the only time they ever had that was during the final Hubble mission. They had two shuttles on the launch pad at the same time, 39A and 39B. One went up in case there was a problem. The other one would have gone and rescued it. There was a plan for that, connecting the two, transferring astronauts and all. That was the only time they had something on the launch pad ready to go. Dick?
Paul, I think he was asking about the supply vehicles, and I think it doesn't matter because they have like 3 months' supply there, so they don't need a backup. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. I think it's more than 3 months, but, you know, they have plenty of stuff on board. And in fact, that's happened. You know, we sent plenty of supply ships up, and they didn't make it. And then they use their reserves, and then they wait for the next flight to go up. Back to you, John.
We're getting very close to the end of our time. We are essentially at the end. That was TechNet number 1,583, and Space Report number 176. The numbers keep getting bigger. The years keep going on. 33 years and 2 months. Craziness. But apparently the gathering of the clan, as almost unorganized as it is, people keep gathering, so there must be enough information flowing to keep this crew happy for 33 years. 33 years under essentially one leadership. Sounds to me like it's close to a record. Bye-bye, you all. We'll be back next week. And we're going to settle almost all of these issues next week. John's going to guarantee that. KC2WGB, the guarantor. K2RW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Full guarantee. And I want to thank everybody for joining the net and the wonderful questions. Keep them coming. We're very interested in your questions. And like we say, it doesn't have to be ham radio as long as it's interesting. It's always good stuff. But Paul, good night, Dick, and enjoy. I'll talk down the
log, KC2WGB. When it comes to all the crazy subjects, I think one subject we've discussed the least is medicine. Now, medicine is a kind of a science, and can you think of how many medical discussions we've had on the TechNet? I am guessing that's one of the smallest popular subjects, unpopular, the most unpopular subjects. Maybe I've got a lousy memory. What do you think, John?
Dick, I think you're right. I mean, I have no expertise at all in that, very little knowledge. You've got much more than I do. But Dr. Roy would be the boy for that. He's got all the answers. We could always lay them on him. Maybe we need a medical net. But, you know, we've had a few, but you're right, not many, because we just don't have the information. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we don't have the information, but we're all getting older. A high percentage of the hams are white hairs. You and me in particular, except for the use of chemistry, we're white hairs. And so medical is going to become a little bit more important as time goes on. There's going to be some techniques in which we're going to be discussing all the aches and pains of our joints and our backs and our walking difficulties and trouble getting up in the morning. Huh. What to look forward to. And here I am climbing towers and hoping I can still keep doing it. Bye-bye, you all. See you down the line. Take your eyes to be clear.
WGB clear.
Report number 1986 with a release date of Friday, November 20th, 2015. The following 5, 4, 3, 2. The following is the QSD. The FCC suffers another temporary outage of its universal licensing system. Amateur community gets ready to recognize hardworking Skywarn volunteers, and a special station operating in the Antarctic refuses to let blizzards get in the way of QSOs. All this and more in Amateur Radio Newsline Report.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
System.